Nice to see you. I'm guessing that the day is beautiful for most of us. I know I've got my window open. I'm also praying for rain because that's actually what should be happening. Hopefully that will return and we will overcome some of our drought. I will start by going around and greeting everyone. And it's all kind of random, like who shows up on the screen in what order. Poor Ruth Ann is always last because she's on a phone. Sarah and John. Aaron, who's not in the frame at the moment, but probably nearby. Joseph. Mark. Katie. Ken. Bob K. Just in case, I don't know if the other Bob's here, but Marv, Paulette, Jim, Jinryu, Mick, Mary, Alice, Joan M. I don't know if the S, Joan M, Pat, Bonnie, Abdullah, Joan Y. Linda, Amelia, Franklin, just in time, Leonella, Sabrina, Tyler, and of course, Ruth Ann. All right. Welcome. So I missed doing that last weekend when we had so many people. I mean, it was exciting to have so many people, but yeah, I guess it would have been a little old greeting 75 people. So let's see. A note. I know a couple people have asked. We did manage to record most of the Gyogu's talk and my dialogue with him last Sunday, and that is posted on the Bright Ways End website, as are all of our Tuesday classes and Sunday talks. So avail yourself of that if you haven't already. And I'm sure, oh, let's see. So our precept classes have started on Tuesdays. If you at all are thinking of receiving the precepts at the end of June and formally becoming a Buddhist, ideally, you would already have been involved with the Sangha for a few months already. I notice there is a pattern of if people show up and they make a lot of commitments right off the bat, that they often leave. And I think it's just kind of too much. And then I don't know what it is, but people. I know for myself, I would probably get kind of overwhelmed and resentful and like, oh shit, this was I committed to too much. And then you kind of just feel like the only option is to back away. So, we do this every year. So if you've been involved for a few months, you know that, this is a sangha for you. Maybe not the only sangha, but a sangha for you. And you're interested in receiving the precepts, I am going to make that possible to do from afar because I just don't have the heart to say no to all of you who are in other states or countries. But you should try to attend the Tuesday night classes. If you really can't for work or whatever, try to listen to the recordings of the classes afterwards. Read one of the recommended texts that on the website under vows and precepts, there's four different recommended texts. And also you want to we should have a meeting about your intention and the state of your practice. And there's a if you want to make an appointment with me there on the website on the very top menu, it says Dharma interview, and it'll take you to a link to my online calendar and you can see when I'm available. And also, I should mention on Thursdays, Victor is has started a precept study group. Now, last week only one person showed up, but they had a good conversation. But that happens, it's a little earlier, so it's better for more easterly time zones. So if you're on the East Coast, you might want to consider joining that study group if you find the Tuesday nights is just too grueling to stay up for. So it happens at 5 Pacific time, which is 8 Eastern time, and bless his heart, that's 9 Brazil time for Victor. So check that out. It's on the website calendar, and it's the same Zoom link if you want to show up to that. Any questions or other events or something that I should be mentioning? Oh yeah. There's the actually I have a list here. There's the Dharma Cloud Day. So on April 25th, so that's 2 weeks away. No, 1 week away. That's 1 week. This next week. Oh my. So next week, you have the option of coming to this lovely program, or at around the same time, it's starting a little bit earlier, ending a little bit earlier. You can participate in an online program with Dharma Rain Zen Center, which is where I trained, where Shintai trained. And the idea is that this once a year, people from related groups, right? I'm a student of Kyogen and Gyokuko's. I started a group. There's a group that Shintai works with in Sandy, Oregon. There's a group down in Eugene. And so these related sanghas all get together for a day of practice to get to know one another. You get to learn a little bit more about, like, what's Domyo's quirkiness and what's, the lineage. What you go somewhere else and you see, oh, they're doing the same thing. It's the same chant. It's the same whatever. And also to have some dialogue with other people who, are in our lineage, our Dharma cloud lineage, but they're practicing in different places and doing different things. And sometimes you get ideas or whatever. If you're interested, we've had a link in our newsletter about that. There's also, it's listed as an event on our website calendar. And if you click on it, you get more information about what the schedule will be and how to hook up to that. So if you skip out next Sunday, I will not take it personally. I will be very happy if you participate in the Dharma Cloud Day instead. But I did want to be here for anyone who just, like, forgets about that or doesn't want to attend. Any questions? All right. So today's talk, I'm calling it Practicing with Our Mistakes. Talking about mistakes in practice and in our lives. What are mistakes? And how do we practice with them? And as usual, by practice, I mean things that we consciously choose to do with our body, speech, or mind to decrease suffering and increase wisdom and compassion. So, how do we practice with mistakes? How should we relate to them, work with them, correct or minimize them, or should we? And to use some of the words from the Kyoju Kaimon, our precept text, how do we sit up straight in the presence of the Buddha despite our mistakes? So, mistakes are, according to the dictionary definition, an error in action, calculation, opinion, or judgment caused by poor reasoning, carelessness, insufficient knowledge, etc. So there's three ways to manifest action according to Buddhist thought: body, speech, and mind. So what makes an error of body, speech, or mind? So that definition of mistake, an error in action, an error in action of body, speech, or mind, essentially, you only have an error if you have an intention. if you have an intention to be correct, or you have an intention, the error is in comparison to that intention. So for example, if with our body, we intend to do something to achieve some particular outcome, we want to throw a ball into a hoop, or we want to sit down in a chair. If the ball bounces off the rim, or we miss the chair and fall onto the floor, it's a mistake. We did this physical act intending to do something, and this then by mistake we did this other thing. And we may care or we may not, depending on the situation, depending on how attached we are to the outcomes and how much it means to our sense of self that we achieved some particular outcome. And then with our speech, we may intend to have a particular outcome with our expression. We want to have a particular effect on someone. We want to be understood. So a mistake is our speech did not have the outcome, the intended outcome. So for example, I explained to you how something you did made me feel betrayed and kind of, you know, the violation of trust. And I want you to understand my experience and hopefully agree to, you know, do something differently in the future so this doesn't happen. Now, if you get defensive and angry and break off our relationship, then my speech was not, I may blame you for that, right? I may think my speech was perfect and you're the one that has the problem. But if I accept some of the culpability, I realize my speech was not, whatever I said didn't get through to you. Whatever I said was not skillful. It didn't do the trick. So in that sense, it's a mistake. And then with our mind, we might intend to understand, intend to have a clear view so that we can make plans for actions that will take care of our lives, that will have good results. And then being deluded or ignorant or having an incomplete understanding is a mistake. And we tend to be even more identified with our minds than with our bodies and speech. And it's kind of this is, you know, where delusion comes in. How do you even know if you're deluded? How do you even know if you're making a mistake in your mind? Your mind doesn't know. It's deluded. So this is a really tricky one. So we all have different relationships to mistakes. Some people are more comfortable with mistakes than other people. Some of us are okay with physical mistakes, but, you know, we're really proud of our speech, you know, and we ability to get ourselves across. And so those mistakes upset us or whatever. And some people constitutionally have kind of an independence or a fierce pride or high self-esteem or something. And, you know, they make a mistake and they're like, you know, I did my best. And so who cares? And moving on. And might not even be willing to apologize for mistakes. But most of us, though, I think would really rather not make mistakes. And, you know, primarily this is because we form our intention for a reason. We want to be responsible. We want to take care of things. We want to create something good. We want to achieve something, you know, we formed our intention for a reason. And to fall short of that, fulfilling that intention is not something that we want to have happen. We're trying. So we want to avoid mistakes for that reason. A second reason is we want to feel competent, to have confidence in our ability to form and follow through on an intention, to have a sense that our executive eye has at least some measure of control over our body, speech, and mind. And the third that reason I could think of is that we want to be seen by others as competent and or disciplined or reliable. So I was looked up some synonyms for mistake, which make me really think, like, this kind of brings it alive for me in terms of I do not want to be associated with these terms. Blunder, confusion, fault, gaffe, lapse, miscalculation, misstep, snafu, blooper, delusion, misinterpretation, misstatement, muddle, overestimation, misjudgment, slip of the tongue. So this third reason, concern about what others think of us, is probably the first one we can work on letting go and getting over to some extent. But there's a lot in the other two in particular that are quite legitimate. Part of being human. We form an intention. We're trying not to make mistakes as we try to fulfill that. So this brings me to a personal story. For 5 months now, I have been playing the accordion. So I played piano for about 8 years when I was a kid. And that's a very strong, like, musical basis. And so, but from age 15 to age 49, I didn't play anything. And I've always wanted to play the accordion. I don't know, something made me finally just order one and give it a shot. And I really, really love it. Accordion music, frankly, can be some of the worst music in the world. Can be terrible, but it can be very beautiful also. Like, it's very, very versatile instrument. And so I've always loved just being able to pull off, the same reason I played piano, pull off like a whole piece all by myself. I don't want to like just be, you know, playing a bass riff that I need to get together with other people to appreciate. I want to do the whole thing. But so I've been enjoying that very much. But one of the things that I noticed was I'm playing these fairly simple, short songs, folk songs and stuff. And I practice, 15 minutes to an hour a day, 5 days a week. And like, I will practice a song dozens of times and break it up into, you separate the right hand and the left hand, and you break up to, you know, just play a couple bars over and over and over. So, you know, your body knows how to do it. But I was finding, and I'm still finding, that when I go to play a song, either for myself, but particularly for other people, I'll make mistakes. You know, my hand doesn't go the right place. I play the wrong note. And so I have an accordion teacher. It's kind of like some of you, I guess, you know, who listen to the podcast and stuff. He's got a website. He records lessons. You can email him. So it's kind of this remote teacher, right? He's up in Vancouver, in Canada. And so I wrote to him saying, you know, I keep on playing. I make these mistakes no matter what. Is there some point at which I'm not going to be making these mistakes? You know, what can I do so I can confidently be like, let me play this for you, right? And then I can play it and I know that I'm not going to make a mistake. And I think he's a great teacher because he very quickly, he recorded this 5-minute video for me and sent a link to it. And he just sat down at his piano in his house. His kids are running around behind him. And he's like, okay, Domeo, here's me now when I answer your question. And it went in a completely different direction than I expected. And he said, well, if you know, I still make mistakes all the time. And it's very difficult when you have that sense of restraint about not veering off what is correct, right? And trying to get it all right. It's a very difficult thing. So he still makes lots of mistakes. But he said what he recommended was that I start working with improvisation, and that on the left hand of the accordion, you have chords you can play. He said, just play, alternate between two chords until it's just like you can talk and look around and be doing this without thinking about it. And then with the right hand, just start playing stuff, you know. Yeah, okay, it's a C chord. You play the C, over here. You play, and then just, he said, when you do this, there's no mistakes, and And then, you know, and that's a, I can't remember what else he said about like why I should do this, but I was intrigued. I'm like, okay, that's not the answer I expected. And then the next day I tried it. And I didn't just do the exercise he recommended. As I started to play my songs, I started to just mess around with them. Just like playing these chords over here, and I'm just gonna start playing some other notes over in the right hand. And it was, I began to feel like when, and then when I did go to play the song, it felt like the notes of the written song were just one path that the music could take, and there's others, and there was just this relaxation. You know, there's just this relaxation of body and mind that made it. I made fewer mistakes, so I thought this was very interesting. And I immediately, when I have that kind of experience, I'm just like, I have to make Dharma out of it. You know, I believe we can learn from everything that we do, right? All has significance. So, as I was reflecting on mistakes, you know, it's like we, like I said, a mistake by definition means you have an intention and that something didn't work out according to your intention. An intention is a direction, an aspiration. It guides our actions, it helps us make decisions and prioritize. So, I mean, I guess you could temporarily solve this tension by just not having an intention. And that sometimes I suppose there's a place for that. But then you're probably not going to sit zazen. You're not going to learn a musical instrument. You're not going to plant a garden. You're not going to study anything or make difficult decisions. Say you're raising a child and you know, now what, how am I going to respond? I got to make the right, you know, decision here, do my best. So if you don't have any intention, I don't know. I guess life would be easier, but I don't know that it would actually. So you wouldn't take a stand against injustice, etc. So I have naturally had to start looking around in the Dharma, and there's a quote that people attribute to Dogen, and I was furiously trying to find exactly where it was from this morning, but all I could get was it quoted in another book that cited a book I have. When I went to that book, I could not find it. I read the whole chapter and I did not find this line. But I'll find it somewhere. I'm assuming that Dogen really wrote it in the Shobo Genzo somewhere. He says, without making mistake after mistake, one departs from the way. So if we don't try, if we don't form an intention, if we don't adopt the precepts, if we don't whatever, we aren't walking the path of awakening. And yet, inevitably, as soon as we set an intention, we fall short. So the nature of our practice is mistake after mistake after mistake. And makes me think also of our precept on do not speak dishonestly, communicate truthfully. So the Bodhidharma precept line is in the realm of the inexplicable Dharma, putting forth not one word is the precept of not speaking dishonestly. You can't, what we convey is a finger pointing at the moon. It's not reality itself. So anytime we try to express something, we're going to fall short of what the truth really is. So damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? So our intention means we try to minimize making mistakes, but our life of practice can be seen as one continuous mistake. So this is Shinryu Suzuki's translation of Dogen's words. So Suzuki says, Dogen Zenji said, Shoshaku Jushaku. So that's quoting from the line that I just read. Shaku generally means mistake or wrong. Shoshaku Jushaku means to succeed wrong with wrong or one continuous mistake. According to Dogen, one continuous mistake can also be Zen. A Zen master's life can be said to be so many years of Shoshaku Jushaku. This means so many years of one single-minded effort. When we give up our intention, something is no longer a mistake. It's just laziness, chaos, letting entropy win. Keeping up with our single-minded effort results in mistake after mistake, but that's practice. But there's another level to Zen, as always. In what sense are there no mistakes? So, you know, this is really, once again, this is absolute and relative, contingent and essential. In the relative world, there are definitely mistakes. We set an intention, we set a goal, we set a direction, and, you know, there are steps that get us further on that path and there's steps that don't. So that's definitely the relative, and that is, it's not that the absolute is more legit. The relative is, they're not separate at all. They're just two traits, two aspects of reality. So in another sense, though, intention is something about time and space. Intention is, I am here and I want to get there. I want to have this happen. So it's something that goes through time, and by its very nature, then it is rather abstract. Something has not happened yet. It is, I am forming a plan about how, you know, this is what I want to have unfold. When we are right in this moment, though, we can hold a different kind of intention to respond as best we can, or to allow the most skillful response we have within us to arise, which has nothing to do with like the next moment, right? It has to do with this moment's response, in which case there's no mistake there, right? If that is our intention and we're right here, there's no way we can't do that. Even if something that we do in a relative sense is a mistake, in a relative sense, oh, you know, I went that way and I should have gone that way. But in this moment, trying to do my best and just be alive and be present and allow my best response to come up, that it wasn't a mistake to go down the wrong road. I was just acting. So here's another piece from Dogen. This is from his extensive record. So these are his Dharma discourses to his monks. So it's a different text than the Shobogenzo. And this is titled Buddha Underfoot. So it's very sweet. Each one of these Dharma discourses has a date. So unlike the Shobogenzo, sometimes you can just really picture Dogen like giving these Dharma discourses to his monks. And sometimes they were recorded by one of his students. And sometimes it'll say like Dogen pauses or Dogen laughs or Dogen clears his throat or something like that. So this is 1241. Enlightenment Day Dharma Hall Discourse. The teacher Dogen said, 2,000 years later, we are the descendants of Shakyamuni. 2,000 years ago, he was our ancestral father. He is muddy and wet from following and chasing after the waves. So I guess this is the waves of suffering sentient beings, and he has been helping to try to deliver them. It can be described like this, but also there is the principle of the way that we must make one mistake after another. What is this like? Whether Buddha is present or not, or present or not present, I trust he is right under our feet. Face after face is Buddha's face, fulfillment after fulfillment is Buddha's fulfillment. So So whether the Buddha is present or not present, I trust he is right under our feet. I don't know what Dogen meant, but when I imagine, okay, so what in my experience might this be? I think of when I'm not trapped in my limited self view, when I have some sense of perspective and gratitude and interdependence, feels like the Buddha is present. When I am all caught up in my self-concern and misery and wrapped up in my mistakes and trying to avoid mistakes, or maybe paralyzed because I'm afraid of making mistakes, it feels like the Buddha is not present. But nonetheless, whatever that experience, the Buddha is right under our feet. And what does this mean? Peace and liberation are available right now, right here, in this moment, in this body. We can't be anywhere other than where we are, anyone other than who we are, even if we've wandered off the intended path into the weeds. So Zen teacher Ko'un France describes it like this. At the start of a hiking trail, we stand and pore over the map, showing us how to get to our destination. But there on the same map is a big red arrow pointing to where we are standing, reminding us, you are here. We can make wrong turn after wrong turn. We can get hopelessly lost. We can give up and go home. But that red arrow doesn't go away. It's one of the hardest things. But next time you don't know where you are or what to do, try starting with, I am here. Plant yourself under that arrow. Then go make some mistakes. So face after face, fulfillment after fulfillment is Buddha's face, is Buddha's fulfillment. And elsewhere in the extensive record, Dogen says, just this is it. So the next face you encounter after this Dharma talk is the Buddha's face. The next time you achieve something and you don't make a mistake, that's the Buddha's fulfillment. So there's a little more from in this Buddha underfoot that I really want to share. So it continues. Last night, so this is Dogen speaking. Last night, this mountain monk, Dogen, unintentionally stepped on a dried turd and it jumped up and covered heaven and earth. This mountain monk unintentionally stepped on it again and it introduced itself saying, my name is Shakyamuni. Then this mountain monk unintentionally stepped on Shakyamuni's chest. And immediately Shakyamuni went and sat on the Vajra seat, saw the morning star, bit through the traps and snares of conditioned birth, and cast away his old nest from the past. Without waiting for anyone to peck at his shell from outside, he received the 32 characteristics common to all Buddhas, and together with this mountain monk composed the following 4-line verse. Stumbling, I stepped on his chest and his backbone snapped. Mountains and rivers swirling around, the dawn wind blew. Penetrating 7 and accomplishing 8, bones piercing the heavens. His face attained a sheet of golden skin. So the golden skin is that's supposedly what a Buddha ends up having. So Dogen's words are poetry. So any prose explanation I give to some extent just obscures whatever resonance that had within you, whatever the words are meant to evoke. You can read it. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if intellectually you understand what it means. So Dogen, he didn't just step on the dried turd unintentionally once. He did it again. I'm just imagining doing this, right? I'm out gardening. in my front yard, somebody's dog is gone, I step in it, I'm trying to get it off my shoe, and then I step in it again. And then the second time, the turd says, "My name is Shakyamuni." This is our life. This is our practice. This is our opportunity. This is it. And then Dogen makes a third mistake. And even though he knows, oh, okay, now this is it. Just this is it. This is my life, right? This is my opportunity. He still steps in it again. And in so doing, somehow, Dogen becomes a causal factor in Shakyamuni's complete and perfect enlightenment. So it's just a very fascinating image there, where it's like, it's not just that, despite stepping on Shakyamuni, he still went on to, achieve enlightenment. It's like, there's this implication that by stepping on him, he actually made this happen. So I will just close by bringing this back to my experience with the accordion, and I feel like it's best expressed in poetic words. So this, I wouldn't even glorify this with the name of poem, but basically it's just not trying to write in complete sentences. So I want to be able to play for you this beautiful song without mistakes. The song deserves that effort. It is so perfect. It will cause your heart to swell. Sadly, this imperfect person cannot yet pull it off. When I am alone, though, I spontaneously and deliberately wander slightly off the written music. Not too far, still paying tribute to the song's beauty, and discover there are no mistakes, only tensions to be beautifully resolved. My authentic self wants to play you a song without mistakes. And my authentic self emerges in my response to this moment, a response which can never be planned. In the end, I think I will be all right. Comments or questions? Go ahead and either unmute yourself or use the reaction button down at the bottom of your screen to do your little raise hand thing. Franklin.
Yeah, hi. Well, first of all, I can identify with the whole music and the steak thing. That's something I deal with all the time. But one of the ways I think about it and really came to mind when you were talking about relative and absolute with regards to music is, notes have no notion themselves, sounds have no notion themselves of their intrinsic value to us, right? And so lately I've been listening to a certain amount of microtonal music, which is not this typical Western 12-tone kind of thing. And it's really interesting how that sort of blurs this idea of a mistake versus not a mistake to our own ears. And so I really liked it, this idea of sound as being like completely neutral, completely devoid of all this other crap that we bring to it, mainly our own mental interpretation. So I really enjoyed the musical analogy. So thanks for all that stuff. It's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just brand new to improvisation. I feel like, because I'm in my 8 years of piano lessons, it was very much like, here's the sheet music, you practice, there's a wrong note, my teacher would color it, and so like improvising is just like, if you were gonna go away from, it's just going to sound terrible. It's going to be awful. You're trying to make beautiful music, and now you're going to like make discordant, awful sounds. So it's like there's actually this fear of improvisation, right? Our fear of mistakes. But But then as I was doing it, and maybe the accordion's particularly suited to this, you know, keeping those chords going and then just playing around. And I realized, like, even when I played a note that didn't sound right, it was discordant with the chord that I was playing, I could move then to a note that did sound good, and it was really beautiful. It was like, here's a tension, and then it was resolved, and it almost looked deliberate. I mean, felt deliberate, and I was like, you know, like, and there was this sense that, you know, that kind of sense of anxiety about all the things that I might face in life. Where am I going to be able to be competent? Am I able to be able to respond appropriately? Am I going to make mistakes? And realizing, like, there's that kind of spontaneous response that we can learn to have confidence in. That, like, whatever, you know, maybe that'll happen, and then, you know, I'll dance with that. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I like the tension and resolution thing is huge. You know, it's all about context and how you go from one to the other, right? And then as far as errors go, you know, a lot of musicians, well, tension and resolution is a huge part of music and just in general, but then, you know, mistakes are a lot about how you respond to them, you know, how do you recover? And so there's a very immediate presence in that as well, right? So that's something as a musician that you, I think good musicians just figure out, yeah, there's going to be mistakes, but how do I, like, what do I, when I make a mistake, what's the next, you know, in the moment thing I do? So yeah, I guess we're turning this into a music discussion, which it wasn't probably not the intent,
But it, I feel like it's not just a metaphor, right? It is, this is
right.
how reality works. And this is just one area where we can kind of see it in microcosm, but it
Yeah,
has greater
I
significance.
agree.
And my husband did observe, so I don't, probably most of you have not observed this in me, because I do tend to be on good behavior around my fellow Zen folks. But, you know, if I'm going around my ordinary daily life and, you know, something gets in my way, drops and whatever, whatever, like, you know, I kind of go, okay, have little rages about these things. But he noticed that when I make mistakes when I'm playing the accordion, that I laugh. So I take that as a good sign. Ken.
I don't remember if I remember all the things I was going to say, but I'll do my best. It seems like for me, the music metaphor is a metaphor for just daily living and practice and being in the moment. And it seems like if you're living in the moment, there is no such thing as a mistake because there's no intention about the future. And like in music, if you play a chord and it doesn't work, you have a new moment, a different moment with which to react to, and to depersonalize that, and to make it not about, to take the self out of it, and to just be about trying to react to the, whether you caused this change or not, to harmonize it, to maintain the metaphor, and improve upon this moment. And if that doesn't work, then you do it again in the next moment. And this is how we live our lives. And it's kind of liberating to not, to see your life as a piece of music, and especially on the accordion, and to be that we're all sort of improvising all the time. And also, I have a confession. When you first read that the Dogen about stepping on the whatever polite word it was, it was funny. As soon as you talked about Shakyamuni being liberated, I immediately envisioned stepping on ketchup packets instead of poop. Remember how much fun that was to step on ketchup packets? And I felt like the ketchup was Shaka Muni reaching new levels of enlightenment. So, that's just me today. So thank you.
And the thing is, you know, if you describe this to your non-practitioner friends and like, yeah, well, you know, because if you're just in the moment, then you don't make, there is no such thing as a mistake. But that sounds contradictory, right? That sounds like, well, we'll just live in the absolute and have no intentions. There won't be any mistakes. And that's like, that's practice is both, right? Practice is like, I'm walking down the street because I need to go to the grocery store and get some food in order to feed myself and my family. But I don't have to live only there. I can also live in this moment. So they can operate at the same time, which is such a delight to find. Sarah.
Hi, thank you. So I'm interested in the idea of incorporating the practice into your daily life and like really trying to live in this state of balance between the absolute and the relative, right? And especially tying in the thought of Buddha's instruction for right occupation and right profession. So in cases like, say, engineering, that since I'm an engineer, where the consequences of failure are really, really high. The idea of making a mistake, I feel like there's a lot of baggage around it. Do you have any thoughts about how to maybe make those where failure genuinely could kill other people? I mean, you have a responsibility, you know, just like in medicine or other professions. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that points out very dramatically, like, you know, the mistake. So I'm going to make a mistake when playing the accordion. I'm going to make a mistake when shooting a basketball. You know, not a big deal. But of course, the mistakes that we're really worried about are, you know, taking care of our families and the kind of thing, you know, if we have work responsibilities like yours. I mean, it really does matter. Like, there's no denying that it matters. Like, you can't talk yourself into like, meh, who cares? But I guess for myself, it's a tricky thing to practice with, because we don't want to just like ditch the relative and whatever. But if we can do that, if we can let go of the relative for zazen or, you know, at particular times and explore this other way of being, what it sells me on it is that it makes me make fewer mistakes. Like, somehow it helps us get out of our own way and we're actually more effective, we're actually more skillful. Our natural or acquired intelligence and knowledge and skills can flow more freely. So, you know, it's that classic thing, like the more freaked out you are about making a mistake, the more likely that you're going to make a mistake to some extent. I mean, there's thoroughness too. And I'm a big fan of thoroughness, but that's a little different, you know? So I guess, I also think about, there's a line from Uchiyama Roshi in How to Cook Your Life, where he talks about the tenzo, making, preparing for the next day's meals. And, you know, all these calculations that he needs to do, how much rice and how many people are present, how many people are sick and they're not going to eat as much and you're not supposed to waste any food. And so he's going through all these, you know, intellectual plans. But then Uchiyama says that is the tenzo's work of this moment. So there's a way that we can engage even in these, you know, relatively aimed pursuits in just this moment, allowing it to unfold without living too far in the future about like, you know, anticipating, you know, what might go wrong or something, but really being present with the task. Just a couple of thoughts. Atlas.
Athletic reference.
Yay.
Ironically, when you play tennis and you give your brain an instruction, just hit the yellow ball. Do really well. But you're not even aware that you're doing well. You're just getting the yellow ball. The second you start thinking about, oh, what do I look like? How many points have I made? What is the other person getting pressured? Am I getting pressured? How can I win this game? How can I beat this person? How can I get better? Then everything just falls apart. It's the irony of athletics, I feel like. Sometimes when you give yourself just a simple task, like look at the yellow ball, hit the yellow ball. It's inexplainable, but like yourself, your body, your mind just literally disappears, and all you're focusing on is the yellow ball. Not even the points, not even the other person, not even yourself. Like everything disappears except for that yellow ball. And then people ask you, oh, what did you do? Like, you were amazing. I don't know what I was doing. I have no idea. I sometimes have to think like the absolute and the relative exists like that, you know? Like the relative is like when you're thinking about points, games, sets, matches, what the other person's doing. Am I a better player than they are? Are they a better player than I am? That's like relative. And then the absolute is just I'm playing tennis. I don't know.
I first encountered this truth in Aikido, and I was just like, damn, this stuff that I'm learning in Zen, like it's literally true. It's literally true. If you can get out of your own head, like, wow, like amazing stuff happens. And I think, you know, just to backtrack a little bit to like Sarah's question, it's been a big, my work has been all intellectual my whole life. So like, it's very clear sometimes in these more physical activities, this like get the self out of the way, let things unfold kind of thing. But like, it just feels different when you're doing an intellectual task. When you have to do an intellectual task, even though, you know, at a certain level, the same thing applies, but how do you, like, it just, it's, you can't, you're certain you're not turning the mind off. I guess for me, then it helps to think a little bit better in terms of wholeheartedness. So if I'm wholeheartedly and undivided in doing my intellectual task, so I'm not doing all that stuff like Alice, you're talking about, like, how about this? And no, I should be doing this instead. And all this extra stuff, but just wholeheartedly doing this intellectual task. Then to me, it has a similar, it doesn't feel the same as a physical activity, but it has that same kind of appropriateness and flow that these other tasks do. So Mick.
Yeah, it's really interesting, like, because I've thought about this in a lot of different contexts of my life, and it's really interesting because I think that, like, you know, I ask my students, I teach in high school, I ask them to, like, I encourage them to make mistakes, right? But at the same time, like, you need to, like... You need to know what you're doing and make the right kind of mistakes and not just like writing down gibberish in the same way that, like, well, with the musical analogy, right? Like, you kind of need to know scales, because those, you know, it's not just like go in and push a bunch of buttons on the accordion, because those aren't the kind of mistakes that I think we're talking about. And so I've really kind of tried to bring this into my practice because I'm probably going to get myself into trouble, but I can't remember exactly what I'm thinking of from Fukan Zazengi, but I feel like Dogen is trying to tell me to let go of a bunch of stuff. And I'm really curious as to what he thinks I should be letting go of. Should I know things ahead of time that I should let go of? And like, or does it like not matter what I know and I should let go of it all? Because I feel like when Dogen says let go, Dogen is much more well-read and he has a better perspective on things than I do. And like, should I get to there and then let go? Or should I just like let go from here? And you know, and I think that's kind of to Sarah's point too. It's not like throw a bunch of gibberish up and tell me that bridge is going to work, right? Like you have to have some expertise, but also like you can kind of let go of it in a very particular way. And I'm really struggling with like, how much do I let go and what do I let go of? And what, like, I don't know. I feel like maybe I need to know more stuff in order to let go of it. If that makes sense.
All I'm thinking of is, I mean, our sad dualistic minds, right? So we read that Dogen says, you know, give up measuring with the intellect, give up good and bad, give up all this. And we go, okay, I'll do that. I'll try to do that all the time. And it's like, no, it's talking about doing that during Zazen. Like, not all the time. So it's like, what we learn is picking up and putting down, right? But we're usually so attached that we can't, like, I can't let go of my, you know, opinions and my mental machinations and all that. I can't put that down. But when we put it down and we see, oh, okay, you know, I'm not actually holding the universe together with my brain. It's still flowing. Okay. You know, so we put it down and then we pick it up. But hopefully, like, we are able to do that freely. So we're not too wrapped up. But yeah, we gotta take care of our lives. And I mean, also in Fukan Zazengi, he says going forward is, after all, an everyday affair. And when I read that, I think about, okay, you know, that's what we're doing here in the Dharma talk too. We're trying to like talk our way closer to it. I mean, what's that about? That's whatever. This is what we do. Just going forward is, after all, an everyday affair. But then there's time and a place to just put it all down. Let's see. We have just a minute. Aaron.
Very quickly. So just sort of picking up on what others have said. So I've done karate for many years, and my teacher, you spend your time and your effort, and you're trying to get to your black belt, And I reached my first degree black belt, and the teacher says, okay, you've learned all the technical skills. Stop thinking about it now. This is when you actually start to learn the flow of the practice. And he told me that when he got his 10th degree black belt, he said, the other people, there's only three other 10th degree black belts in my style of karate. They all came up to him and said, okay, stop what you were doing. You're starting over again with a new cycle. You know, just that's, and it's endless. You learn the technical skills, then you let go and you start a whole new progression of learning by letting go of everything. So anyway, that resonated with talking about tennis and, you know, teaching and all those other things. You learn the technical skills. Okay, let it go now. Feel the flow of it. And that's sort of what resonated. And also just as a sort of give you a sense of where my sick and twisted mind is. When you were reading the story of the mountain turd, I'm sorry, but the first thing that came to mind was Mr. Hankey from South Park. I don't know if, you know, a lot of people know the reference, but anyway. Dispensing wisdom about, you know, the value of life and Christmas from the most ridiculous possible sources. And that's exactly what came to mind. Thanks.
I mean, I hope that at least a few people today are going to leave going, that's not a story I expected from Dogen. And then the turd said, I am Shakyamuni. Like, what? All right. Well, it's 12:16, so I'll close with our verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Have a good week.